Welcome to Lord John Lander, the Outlander podcast for Lord John fans, where we talk about all things Outlander, but especially about Jaime and his Sassenach.
And sometimes we talk about Claire, too.
For however long it takes, we'll lead you on a journey so chaotic, you'll question every life choice that led you to be here today. And like the Hotel California, you can check out anytime, but you can never leave.
We may not be the Outlander podcast you wanted, but we will be the Outlander podcast you didn't know you needed.
Now, before we get into it, this is your one and only warning that show and book spoilers are lurking around every corner. We're going to spoil stuff from future seasons, future books, and our own brains.
Remember, if you can't prove our headcanon didn't happen, then we can only assume that it did.
If you make it through the episode in one piece, we'd love to hear from you. Send us your burning questions, wild theories, thick prompts, flattering compliments, or whatever's on your mind. You can contact us on Twitter and Tumblr at Lord John Lander or on our website at lordjohnlander.wordpress.com, where you'll also find our archived episodes, teasers, thick recs, and more.
Hello, welcome to the season 2 finale of Lord John Lander. We are your hosts. I am Mistress Pandora, but you can call me Pan.
And I'm Beth.
Can you believe we have finished season 2? I feel like there were days where it didn't feel like the end of season 2 was ever going to happen.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we started off the first half and it was so quick. And then we took that nice long break, but then I think we were just like, the break just gave us time to throw all our energy into the holidays, which is not relaxing or like a break at all.
No, not remotely.
So then we were like, came back and we were just like, not rested at all because it was over the holidays. I mean, we may as well have like, just
keep going
recording, yeah, because it was like, not restful at all. Yeah, but we made it. Looks like we made it.
Okay. I think our listeners may have noticed a few things that have changed over the course of this season. Because of that, when we came back from, well, let me back up a little bit. So you may have caught that you guys were on a hiatus for a few weeks, but our hiatus was not quite that long. We only took about 2 weeks off in the middle. We tried to keep 2 to 3 weeks of recording in the can just in case, you know, life happened, because life happens. We're both parents. We both have jobs, you know, shit occurs.
Yes.
But yeah, after the holidays, we realized that we were having a difficult time keeping up with all of these wonderful ideas that we had and we were enjoying doing, but it was just a lot. Yeah. And so we slacked off on a couple of things and we let the teaser Tuesdays go because it was just too much. There was a lot that went into creating those and they were fun while we did them. I loved seeing them. Beth, you're a genius. You learned a new skill.
I did. Yeah, it was fun, but it became sort of like, it was a lot. It was a lot to do every week, and because, you know, both of us also have other interests.
Yeah.
Besides also being, you know, like you said, we're both mothers, we both have full-time jobs, but we also both have other interests, so trying to balance all of that was just becoming really difficult. So we dropped a few things that were fun, but not necessarily necessary.
Not necessarily necessary.
Not necessary to this podcast, you know, being recorded and posted for everyone to listen to, which is the primary purpose of the podcast.
Yes. So we may at some point in the future, we may decide that we want to pick that up at a random week, come up with a video or some sound bites or something that we want to drop ahead of an episode. Maybe. Don't know. We reserve the right to be spontaneous, either planned or not.
Or I might decide to do a video edit at some point and just throw it up there. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
The sky's the limit.
Yeah, we're always down for shenanigans. Who knows? Who knows what'll happen? So let's a couple of things we're going to do this week. Obviously, we're not talking about an episode of the show specifically. So just like season one, if you feel like you missed an episode, wait, I thought season two only had 13 episodes. It does, but not us, because we're over.
We have 14 because we just want an episode at the end to just like hear ourselves talk, basically.
Oh, we need the last word. We have to have the last word. So we'll finish up Beth's history lesson. She's got a couple of years left, one or two decades, maybe some just, dead monarchs, I'm sure.
You know, just like another, 100 years or so. It's all good.
And then we'll talk out our asses, bullshit some stuff, and see what happens. And then we'll tell you guys what season three is going to be like.
Yeah.
So, Beth, you want to hit that history lesson?
Sure. So, I know last week I promised that I was going to like skip ahead to the Glorious Revolution in 1688 because I spent last week just completely just focused on Mary, Queen of Scots. But then I was like just reading some of the history to get me caught up to the Glorious Revolution. And I found out that James VI, her son, James VI and James I, was actually had some pretty fabulous things about his life that made him very appropriate for our interests. So ooh. I figured that would be nice because, the finale, we're just kind of doing a lot of bullshitting. And I thought we would probably have some nice, lively discussion around James VI. So I figured, let's go with it. We'll just go with the flow and see where this takes us. So James VI, he was the 2 times great-grandson of Henry VII of England. His mother was Mary, Queen of Scots, and his father was Lord Darnley. They were first cousins. They were both great-grandchildren of Henry VII. And then also Lord Darnley was a descendant of James II through James II's daughter, Mary Stuart. He took the throne in Scotland in 1567 when his mother, Mary Queen of Scots, was compelled to abdicate in his favor, but he was only 13 months old at the time. There were 4 different regents who governed until he reached his majority in 1578, but even then he didn't quite gain full control until 1583. So around 1579, when James was 13, James's first cousin once removed, his name is Esme Stort, and he was from France. He arrived in Scotland, and he quickly became James's most trusted advisor and was appointed to the Privy Council in 1580 and was made Lord Darnley, which was his father's title, and Earl Lennox. In 1581, James made Esme Stort Lord Aubigny. I don't even know how to say that. Lord Dalkeith, Lord Torbolton, and Lord Aberdour. He was also made Earl of Darnley and Duke of Lennox, and at the time, he was the only duke in Scotland.
Ooh.
Yes.
Oh, I see where this is going.
So, unfortunately, the age difference is completely yucky, but we still have to talk about this. James VI also gave Esme Stort jewels that remained from the collection of Mary, Queen of Scots, including a gold belt or chain of knots of pearls and diamonds, then later a gold cross with diamonds and rubies, then the Great Harry or Great H of Scotland, which was a chain of rubies and diamonds with a diamond carcan necklace. And I didn't even get a chance to look up what carcan is, but it had roses and gold and a pair of hair garnishings. And then another suite of carcan, which I think it's this diamond necklaces, and more hair garnishings and other pieces. So he like gave this guy like all of his mother's jewelry. So Esme was Catholic, but he converted to Protestantism. Remember that the Protestant Reformation happened in Scotland during Mary, Queen of Scots' reign. And there's just like a lot of contention between the Catholics and the Protestants. So Esme converted to Protestantism, but he still wasn't popular among the Scottish Calvinists, who saw the affection between Esme and James and alleged that, and they called him Lennox because that was his Duke title. They alleged that Lennox went about to draw the king to carnal lust. Interesting. So they didn't like him and they thought he had way too much influence over James. So in August of 1582, two prominent Protestants raided Ruthven Castle and forced Lennox to leave. And James VI was imprisoned until June of 1583. What is it with these Scottish rulers getting imprisoned by their people? it's a lot. When he was released finally in 1583, he did tighten his rule and he passed the Black Acts, which gave the crown authority over the church, which went over like a lead balloon.
I would imagine.
He did rule pretty effectively from 1583 to 1603, although there was some attempts on his life. One of them was in 1600. It just kind of seems par for the course for these Scottish rulers. In 1586, he was really kind of sucking up to Elizabeth I. Because he, like his mother, had eyes on the English throne. He signed the Treaty of Berwick with England, and then his mother was executed in 1587. And he assured Elizabeth I of his support as her, quote, natural son. Elizabeth sent him an annual subsidy every year. Part of that was like she was just trying to maintain some control over him and Scotland. So it was like kind of this mutual devious plotting. James had been praised for his chastity in his youth since he showed little to no interest in women.
Let's sit with that for a moment.
Let's sit with that for a minute.
Okay, go on.
Yes. After the loss of Lennox, he continued to prefer male company, but he did need to marry. So he married 13-year-old Anne of Denmark by proxy. And for some reason, I didn't write the year down, but after they were married by proxy, she set sail for England. But there were some storms and she was forced to the coast of Norway. Now, I just laughed so much at this because I could hear the sarcasm coming through. This historian, David Harrison Wilson, called this the one romantic episode of James's life when he sailed from Leith to personally fetch her. It's like, oh my God.
Just good friends.
I have to say, though, that's like kind of a little sketchy because, as you will find out in a little bit in a few seconds, he seemed to have many romantic gestures in his life. They just weren't directed towards his wife. They did have 7 children, 3 of which survived to adulthood. Their oldest son, James, though, died when he was 18, leaving their daughter, Anne, and their son, Charles, who became the heir apparent. Then Elizabeth died in 1603, and James ascended to the English throne as James I. So one thing to kind of distinguish is that this actually didn't like officially unite England and Scotland as one country, but it was considered what was called a personal union, which was when a monarch ruled over different countries at the same time. It wasn't like codified in the laws. There wasn't like any combined parliament or anything like that. But he kept a pushing for like a real union between England and Scotland, but neither England or Scotland really wanted that. He kept pushing the agenda anyways. And in 1604, the messy bitch that he is, he demanded the Scottish Parliament call him James, King of Great Britain, which they did do. But then he was told by someone else, like, you do know that you have like no legal authority to use that name and you like can't use it in like any official proceedings or like legal matters or anything like that. And this began the era of the Storts just kind of declaring themselves things that they weren't. It's a family tradition. So throughout his life, James had close relationships with male courtiers, which has caused some debate among historians about their exact nature, but I'm going to talk a little bit about these things, and then you tell me where you see the debate. So some of James' biographers conclude that Esme Stuart, Robert, who was the Duke of Lennox, Robert Carr, who was made the Earl of Somerset, and George Villiers, who became the Duke of Buckingham, were his lovers. I hesitate to really call Esme Stuart a lover, since James was like 13 at this time, and Esme was like 30-something, so, but we'll just let that.
It was a thing at the time.
We're not going to pick it apart. A contemporary of James said that he had never yet saw any fond husband make so much or so great dalliance over his beautiful spouse as I have seen King James over his favorites, especially the Duke of Buckingham, whom the king would tumble and kiss as a mistress. And later on, when there was restoration of a palace in Northamptonshire, this took place in like 2004, it revealed a previously unknown passage linking the bedchambers of James the VI and James the I and Villiers, the Duke of Buckingham.
All the plot thickens. Okay.
A contemporary Huguenot poet observed that this is written as a poem. It is well known that the King of England fucks the Duke of Buckingham. He like just was like, nice. I'm just gonna say it.
Said the quiet part out loud.
He's like the Perez Hilton of of the 1600s. Buckingham himself provides evidence that he slept in the same bed as the king, writing to James many years later that he had pondered whether you loved me now better than at the time, which I shall never forget, at Farnham, where the bed's head could not be found between the master and his dog. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's just a lot to take in.
It's amazing. This is apparently the way you get me interested into history this old in another country, is make it gay.
Yeah. So some historians, though, argue that they were not lovers. And one of the reasons that they used to argue that was because he had 7 children with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You know what? While you're continuing this, Lord John has something to say about that. Keep going. I'm still here. Just get in the book. Just keep going.
And then some of them, even that letter that Buckingham wrote to him, some of these guys were like, no, like that's like totally platonic. I don't even know what you guys are talking about, which is like, you know, those historians that are always just like, they were the best of friends. And the fact that they shared a bed and like kissed each other and stuff, that was just how men behaved with their best friends those days in that time.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how gay men behaved with their best friends at that time.
Their lovers. Yeah. That's. Mm-hmm.
And then of course there is the possibility that he was bisexual, which, you know, is completely possible. But I think it's pretty clear that he preferred the company of men. So I was like, wow, I have to include this because this is Lord John Lander, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was like, fabulous. So, yeah. So as you're looking for that thing from Lord John, in his later years, James suffered increasingly from arthritis, gout, and kidney stones. He also lost his teeth and drank heavily, another issue with the Stuarts, some of the Stuarts. He was often seriously ill during the last year of his life and died on March 27th, 1625, during a violent attack of dysentery. With Ooh. Buckingham at his bedside. Okay, Aww. I'm sorry. Aww. If you are dying of dysentery, anybody who's at your bedside is not just your friend.
Yeah, nope, nope.
No. Nope. No one's going to sit with you at your bedside while you're dying of dysentery unless they, like, really love you, okay?
And dear listeners, if you don't know why, Google what dysentery does to the body.
Yes.
Just, yeah. It's not just pretty.
We're not going to describe it, but you can look for yourself. Like, yep. Ain't nobody sitting by your bedside unless they are 100% devoted to you. Like,
oh, yeah.
No. Nope. Okay, so we found the passage that Pan was just referring to when I said that some historians try to say that James the VI couldn't have been gay because he had 7 kids with his wife. So then we found the passage from Echo and the Bone.
Yes.
But then we have to unpack it even a little more. This whole scene is funny. So this is not the scene... This is not the morning after they had, like, they, like, ravaged each other.
Wild, drunk sex.
This is just, like, a normal day, and Claire is sad about Jamie.
Pause. It's never a normal day when... It is never a normal day. First of all, period. Secondly... It's never a normal day when "do you wish me to comfort you" is a euphemism for "shall I fuck your brains out again, ma'am?" That's not a normal day, Beth.
So
I mean, I guess it is if you're Lord John or his wife.
So basically he comes in because she's crying, and he's like, "Oh, you're very lonely. Will you let me keep you company for a little bit?" And she, like, Claire's like, just moves over, and John gets in the bed with her. And then they don't really say anything. And then all of a sudden, he's like, "Do you wish me to comfort you? I do know how, you know." And then he reaches down. He moves a finger very slowly in such a place and with such exquisite delicacy that I gasped and jerked away. I cannot wait for season 7. Oh my God. See, I knew this would spark a good conversation. So let me get this straight.
Wait, no.
You know, Claire is like resting her head on his shoulder or whatever, which is, you know, so nice. But like,
they're snuggling.
Instead of just like a hug, John's like,
he slips her a finger.
But he's totally not into women, guys. Totally not.
No.
And Claire's like, yeah, I do know that you know how to do this, but I can't right now because I would feel a little unfaithful to Jamie, which is a little late for that.
But anyway,
she's just not in the mood, which is fine. No is no. Then
so he doesn't actually say that he removes his finger from her personal person, but we can assume
she jerked away.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Who does that?
So then she's like, you know, no, I'm, you know, I'm kind of sad. I'd feel a little unfaithful, kind of, you know, because she's having this realization that John is going through like pretty much the same thing she is,
yeah,
in his mourning and stuff like that, which I don't know if we have time to unpack that.
We don't.
But it's true.
We should, but we don't. Maybe we can maybe circle back,
yeah,
to it.
And then she's like, so you wouldn't feel unfaithful? And he's like,
a standing cock is quite blind, my dear.
So,
that was the line.
Wait, so his wife is His wife of convenience, quote unquote, is crying over her dead husband, and he's like, "I know what to do."
He's like, yes. Like,
yeah, he's sad too. And he's like, I know what to do because this worked out really well a few nights ago. so he goes in and
fingers her.
Offers to jack her off. And then, and then he's like, but by the way, while we're here, I could use some comfort. and she's like, true. And then, so then she takes him gently but firmly in hand and deals with him in tender silence.
Just nice. Nice, friendly hand job between bros.
And, you know, it's hilarious because I'm, all I can think of is, like, there's so many freaking similarities between John and Claire. But, like, to Claire, because we know so much about, like, we have so much more of, like, Claire's inner thoughts and, you know, stuff than we do of John's.
Yeah.
But we know, like, and Jamie says it too, like, you think with your body, like, she's a very physical person. Mm-hmm. She's a very sexual person. And so to her, this is actually kind of just like, that makes, it makes total sense to her that that's what John would want, that, that they would both want that for comfort. And I'm like, but John obviously is the exact same way. Like,
yes.
It's just like another thing and that's like so similar.
But when I tag a fic emotional support orgasms, people think that's funny, but it's in character.
It's, it is in character. And just anybody who out there who may be similar to this, like, it's totally fine. Like,
yeah,
this, everybody's different, but like, I'm just like fascinated by John and Claire's similarities. And what's interesting is that we never obviously get to see John to date, except for Stefan. We really don't get to see John interact with his lovers much in any of the books. But what we do see of him with Stefan, he's very demonstrative with and touchy. Oh, yeah, that's true. I can't remember how touchy he was with Percy. But he's, I feel like John would be someone who, if he had someone that he could, you know, and had a place where he could just be sort of openly affectionate with him, he would be the type to be touching all the time, you know?
Yeah. So, remembering Brotherhood of the Blade, John and Percy, when they were in private, obviously, they were quite affectionate and physically demonstrative. There was a lot of, like, laying in bed, reading together kind of thing.
Yeah. That's so cute.
Yeah, it was very sweet. And even when they were out in public, you know, they weren't, you know, they'd stay together when they were going out and doing things. They would go to, like, museums and test their gaydar on the paintings, which was always hysterical. And if you think I'm lying, you didn't read the book. It's not remotely an exaggeration. But yeah, so
No, it's not.
So even in public, though, they weren't necessarily, like, being open about the nature of their relationship, but their conversation was intimate, and they had a lot of, not necessarily like inside jokes, I mean, but think about how Diana describes Claire and Jamie communicating non-verbally or in, like, half sentences, code words kind of thing. They have the same kind of way of communicating when they're out in public.
Yeah.
I think with Stefan von Nomsen, he was more, Stefan was less reserved as a person, yes, just in general. And it was something that actually turned John off at first.
Yeah.
But then had him, like, questioning every interaction with him, like, throughout most of the short stories. Like, his hand is on my thigh. Does this mean any calf? Excuse me. Does this mean anything, or is he just trying to make sure I don't fall off this horse? That's really large. I don't know. Like, what's going on here? And this poor guy is just talking to him. He's like, I wasn't listening. They had a lot of physical intimacy, more so in public than John and Percy did. But I think that was just more of the like Stefan's personality, more of his nature. He was more outgoing and touchy with other people.
He wasn't
and
English.
Friends just in general. Right. He was not frightfully British.
But so, and then like talking about that, sort of almost bringing it right back to the history lesson, like,
oh God, we still have a lot to go.
Yeah. Can you imagine historians observing John with Percy and being like, they were stepbrothers. Their relationship was just so sweet and they were so demonstrative with each other, and they had like inside jokes, and they had, you know, they could speak to each other without speaking. And it just shows what brotherly relationships were like back then.
No.
And no. It's sort of like if you try to like put that historian perspective on some of these things, it's like, God, they're fucking idiots. Anyway.
Homophobes, but
well, yes, that too.
But yeah, so keep that in mind when you hear historians say bullshit stuff like, oh, he had 7 children with his wife. A standing cock is quite blind, my dear.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
All right. See, I knew my history lesson was going to be a good conversation starter today.
That was fun as
hell. So when James died in 1625 of dysentery with his very, very good friend, the Duke of Buckingham at his side.
How do you say that with a straight face?
His son Charles became king of England, Ireland, and Scotland, and he was known as Charles the First in all of those countries, which made it less confusing. So Charles, right after his succession, he quarreled with English Parliament. They were trying to curb his royal prerogative. And see, Charles believed in the divine right of kings and was determined to govern according to his own conscience. And the English Parliament was like, we don't really like that. He was married by proxy in 1625 to the 15-year-old French princess Henrietta Maria in front of the doors of Notre Dame de Paris. A lot of members of the House of Commons opposed his marriage to a Catholic because they were afraid he would lift restrictions on the Catholics and undermined the official establishment of the Reformed Church of England. Charles told Parliament that he would not relax religious restrictions. He was like, so they were like, we don't like this marriage because we're really worried that you're going to like bring Catholicism back. And he was like, guys, totally no worries. I'm not going to do anything like that. I promise. Like the religious restrictions are going to against the Catholics are going to totally remain in place. But then he promised to lift the religious restrictions in a secret marriage treaty with his brother-in-law, Louis the 13th of France. So, yeah.
I got you, bro.
Yeah, he's like, guys, chill. Like, I got you. And then he's like, yo, Louis.
Chill, yeah, I got you.
I can do that. So you can kind of see here, especially, I mean, the Scots and the French have always had this like pretty good relationship, but you can see here really this it getting more solidified with Charles marrying Princess Henrietta, and they became closer, you know, as the Stuarts were trying to kind of get a little more little more power back to the Catholic Church. All right. So a lot of his subjects opposed his policies. He had a habit of like levying taxes without parliamentary consent. And so a lot of people just saw him as a tyrannical absolute monarch. And his religious policies generated mistrust from reformed religious groups like the English Puritans and the Scottish Covenanters, who thought his views were too Catholic. And part of his taxes thing, he provoked more unrest by trying to raise money for a war through a quote-unquote forced loan, which was just basically another tax that was levied without parliamentary consent. His entire reign was marked by religious conflicts, and there were several wars, including this war called the Bishop's War and also the English Civil War. He was just not a popular king. Nobody really liked him. And in 1649, he was accused of treason against England by using his power to pursue his personal interest rather than the good of the country. And he stood trial and was sentenced to execution.
Whew.
Yeah. And this all happened within like 1 month. Like at the beginning of January, he was accused of treason. They had his trial. And then on January 30th, he was executed. His execution went much better than Mary Queen of Scots, so I didn't really write much about it.
Oh, good.
His son, Charles II, was made King of Scotland, but for a while, English was under the power of Oliver Cromwell, so it was kind of just operating as a de facto republic, and I can't get into Oliver Cromwell, obviously, but if you are interested in this stuff, he's a pretty interesting character in history. Charles was still trying to like gain control back of England, but in 1651, Cromwell defeated Charles and he fled to mainland Europe, and he lived in exile for about 9 years in the Dutch Republic and the Spanish Netherlands. And Cromwell was basically a dictator of England, Ireland, and Scotland during that time until he died in 1659. And then the monarchy was restored. Charles came back. He had a policy of religious tolerance, though he did kind of have to acquiesce to the Church of England sometimes in Parliament and give them a little something. There was this thing called the Clarendon Code, which kind of shored up the position and reestablished the Church of England. But he was basically like, you guys, you do you, you know, just everybody kind of worship God however you want. I don't really care. In 1670, he entered into the Treaty of Dover. So this was an alliance with his cousin, King Louis XIV. Now, Louis XIV is the king known as the Sun King. He's the guy that like built Versailles, and he was a very beloved king in France. And he reigned for like a really long time. In fact, he reigned for so long that his son, although his son lived well into adulthood, he never became king. He died before Louis XIV, and then Louis XV, which is the Louis that we see in Outlander, was his grandson, took the throne after when the Sun King died. So Louis agreed to aid Charles II in the Third Anglo-Dutch War, and he also like paid him a pension. In exchange, Charles secretly promised to convert to Catholicism, but like at an unspecified future date.
Like he was sometime. Like, someday.
Yeah, like, it's cool. Like, it'll happen. I promise. Like,
totally.
I'm a little busy right now. My calendar's kind of full, but I'm totally going to do it when I get a chance. And then Charles actually attempted to introduce religious freedoms for Catholics and Protestant dissenters. In 1672, he had this thing, it was the Royal Declaration of Indulgence, but the English Parliament, always such a buzzkill, forced him to withdraw it.
Buzzkill.
So in 1679, there was this guy, I did not have time to look into him very much, but he basically, his name is Totus Oates. Titus Oates. Totus Otis. Titus Oates. He fabricated that there was this Popish plot, and literally it's called the Popish plot, but it was made up, but it sparked a crisis, and it was revealed that Charles's brother and his heir, who was also his heir presumptive, James, Duke of York, had become a Catholic. So basically, Charles had promised to become a Catholic when he got around to it, but his brother, who was his heir, had already become a Catholic. So Charles II just was like, I'm just going to dissolve English Parliament and rule by myself until my death. So he was just like, bye, guys. I'm just going to do this on my own. But he was one of the most popular English kings, and he's known as the Merry Monarch, which is a reference to the liveliness and hedonism of his court. So cheers to you, Charles II. We love a hedonistic monarch.
Do we?
So the reason that his brother James was heir presumptive is because Charles II had no legitimate children. He did, however, have at least, he acknowledged at least 12 illegitimate children by various mistresses. Those are just the ones he acknowledged. 12.
Lordy.
Maybe we don't love a hedonistic king. So he was succeeded by his brother, James, and James became James the 7th of Scotland and James the 2nd of England in 1685. He was the last Catholic monarch of England, Scotland, and Ireland, and his reign is now remembered primarily for conflicts over religious tolerance. So this all sort of sparked when Mary, Queen of Scots, was just becoming queen, and it's just, they're just, ever since the Reformation, they're just constantly fighting. His son was born in 1688. He has had some other children that died, and the only ones that so far that had lived were his daughters, Anne and Mary, and they were adults at the time that James the Seventh's son, James Francis Edward, was born in 1688. But this was like, he was really happy about that because that meant that James Francis Edward would be his heir apparent, and he basically wanted to establish a Roman Catholic dynasty with James and exclude his daughters, Mary and Anne, from the line of succession because they were Anglicans. And Mary had married a Protestant, William of Orange. She was in line for the succession before James Francis Edward was born. In September of 1688, it was clear that William of George, so this is James the Seventh's son-in-law, was going to invade, but James thought his army was sufficient, so he refused offers of help from his cousin Louis the 14th. When William did arrive in November of that year, a bunch of Protestant officers on James the Seventh's side defected and joined William, including his own daughter, Anne. So James basically lost his nerve and declined to attack the invading army. So he just was like, I guess nobody likes me, so I'm just going to sit this one out, guys. And in December, he tried to flee to France. So I think James had a little penchant for the dramatic as well, because he tried to flee to France. But before he did, he threw the great seal of the realm into the River Thames. He was just like, if I can't have it, nobody can. He was captured in Kent, but then he was later released and placed under Dutch protective guard. But William of Orange, he did not want to make James a martyr, so he basically let James escape. James was received by his cousin and ally, Louis the 14th, who offered him a palace in France and a pension. So he, in 1688, he leaves Scotland. Parliament actually refused to depose him. They were like, nah, we're not about that, man. But he did flee to France, and he did fling the Great Seal into the Thames before he did so. So basically, he abdicated.
So it's exactly the same thing. That's what I saw. Isn't that what you saw?
That's what I heard. The image I have of him throwing the seal into the Thames, because like all I can picture is like the Bonnie Prince, like the someone of similar stature with like this big big freaking thing. I don't even know what it is. And just like, like throwing it into the tank. Anyway.
Actually, it's not, it wouldn't have been that big. So it was like, what would have been used to stamp the wax?
Oh, that's okay. Yeah.
It's small. So that was a bolt. Did they ever get it back?
I don't know.
Because it's not like they could go scuba diving.
Be warned, English rulers. If you throw the Great Seal into the Thames, it means you abdicated. I'm pretty sure that's how, you know, Edward, the guy that married Wallace Simpson, I'm pretty sure that's how he abdicated too. Ugh, just throwing it in.
Skipping rocks.
So then in 1689, the Parliament of Scotland were like, yeah, we totally agree. He's basically forfeited his throne here too. So then James's daughter, Mary, was declared queen, and she was to rule jointly with her husband, William of Orange. So James VII's dream of his son, James Francis Edward, whoever's ruling over a Catholic dynasty never came true because his daughter ended up becoming queen. James VII was just chilling with his cousin Louis, and Louis offered some help to James, like now and again. He even offered to have him elected king of Poland. But James was like, nah, I feel like if I do that, then I'll never be able to be king of England again. I will give one thing to the Storts is that their stubborn belief in their own greatness is unmatched. But then in 1697, Louis made peace with William of Orange. So he kind of stopped offering things to James. James still was living in Paris. His son was there with him and all of that. So he was still living a pretty good life. And then he died age 67 of a brain hemorrhage. This is another fun thing. If you're squeamish, just fast forward, like, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds.
A new content warning. I was not anticipating.
So he died of a brain hemorrhage. His heart was placed in a silver gilt locket and given to the convent at Chaliot. His brain was placed in a lead casket and given to the Scots College in Paris. His entrails were placed in two gilt urns and sent to the parish church of Saint-Germain-en-Laye and the English Jesuit College at St. Omer. So they split those up and sent them away. And the flesh of his right arm was given to the English Augustinian nuns of Paris.
Why?
I don't know. It's just the flesh. And then the rest of his body was laid to rest in a triple sarcophagus consisting of two wooden coffins and one of lead at the St. Edmund's Chapel in the Church of the English Benedictines in Paris.
Pause. I can't help it because was there like a stake rigged into this? Were we afraid he was going to rise again? What in the actual fuck? What?
I will look into it more because I didn't get a chance to. Like, I just...
Why did they chop him up like a side of beef?
And like, I don't know if it was like his wishes.
Who the fuck would ask for that?
Oh, wait, what is this? Hold on. Jacobite.ca.
That's a thing.
I guess Canadians love Jacobites too. Let's see. Oh, his body actually waited in that church because it was supposed to be sent to Westminster Abbey. But then in the French Revolution, it was desecrated by the mob and lost. Lost also during the Revolution were his remains at the Scots College, the Visitian Convent of Chaliot, and the English Core Church of St. Omer. Yeah, so it doesn't say why, but a lot of it was all destroyed in the French Revolution.
Ew. Okay.
Okay, so we're almost done here, guys. I promise. But I could not leave out these, like, messy details, you know?
Oh, this is incredible. This is the most enthralled I've been. this history lesson has everything.
These bitches are so messy. I fucking love it. Okay, so James's younger daughter, Anne, succeeded to the English throne when William died in 1702. But I just would like to point out that when James died, the Jacobite support, well, they weren't really called Jacobites then, but the supporters of the Stuarts, like, declared his son, James Edward Francis, to be James the 8th and 3rd. Like, and then he just grew up, like, calling himself James the 8th and 3rd of Scotland and England. Like, he just was like, I am, so fuck you. Like, I don't care what anybody else says.
Oh.
Remember I said earlier this, yeah. They just kind of declared themselves to be things. Okay, so when Anne succeeded to the throne in 1702, the Act of Settlement provided that if the line of succession established in the Bill of Rights was executed, so the line of succession with Mary and William of Orange and then her sister Anne, if it extinguished because they had no heirs, the crown would go to a German cousin, Sophia, Electress of Hanover, and to her Protestant heirs. So Sophia died in 1714, and 2 months later, Queen Anne died. So she was succeeded by George I, who was Sophia's son. So that is how the Hanovers ended up becoming the rulers of England, if you've ever wondered how this German family ended up being in charge of England.
I have, actually. Now I know.
Now you know. So James's son, like I said, was recognized as king at his father's death. Oh, and Louis the 14th also recognized him as king. And he was known as James the 3rd and James the 8th. So French support had been crucial for the Stuart exiles, but they had to accept the Protestant succession in Britain as part of terms that ended the War of the Spanish Succession, which took place from 1701 to 1714. The Stuarts started to lose favor in the French court, and then they were banished from France by the terms of the 1716 Anglo-French Treaty. Essentially, they ended up going to Italy, where they were given a palace and like refuge by the Pope. So now we're up to the Jacobite Rising of 1715. So we're almost there. On the 14th of March, 1715, James Francis Edward Stuart appealed to Pope Clement the 11th for help with the Jacobite Rising. He believed that this guy, the great General Marlborough, was going to join him. In August of that year, he wrote to the Duke of Berwick, who was his illegitimate brother, and said, I think it is now more than ever, now or never. So he was like gearing up, and there were all these like letters being written and stuff. But then this guy, the Earl of Mar, without getting any sort of signal from James Francis Edward Stuart, he just was like, I'm going to sail to London, from London to Scotland, and I am just going to like hold a council of war there.
as one does.
Yeah, you know. I have to say, you know, these Scots are very bold. They just take what they want. He had this war council in Aberdeenshire on September 6th. He raised the standard of James the 8th and 3rd, and they had about 600 supporters at the time that were there for that. In 1715, Parliament responded to this with the Habeas Corpus Suspension Act. This act confiscated the land of rebelling Jacobite landlords in favor of their tenants who supported the London government. So basically, if your landlord was supporting the Jacobites, you could appeal to Parliament and be like, I think I should have his land because I support you guys. And people actually tried to do that with this Mar guy. So the Jacobites ended up invading. They did take Inverness, Gordon Castle, Aberdeen, and Dundee. The only thing really they weren't able to capture was Fort William. But by October of that year, his forces had taken control of all of Scotland above the Firth of Forth, apart from Stirling Castle. But he was like indecisive about what to do next. And I just feel like this indecisiveness was the downfall of like both the risings in the 1700s. So he hesitated, which gave the Hanoverian commander, the Duke of Argyll, time to increase his strength with reinforcements from the Irish garrison. So then in November of that year, there was a battle at Sheriffmuir. The Jacobites actually numbered 4,000 to Argyll's 1,000, and they began to advance on Argyll, who was poorly protected, but then he didn't close in for some reason. Mar didn't close in. I guess he maybe believed that he'd won the battle already. Argyll had already lost over 600 men, which was three times the amount of men that the Jacobites had lost. But instead of just like closing in and finishing the job, they just retreated to Perth.
Well,
I don't really understand. Oh, on the same day as this battle, Inverness surrendered to the Hanoverian forces. And then there was a smaller Jacobite force that included English Jacobites that was defeated at Preston. On November 15th of that year, 3,000 Dutch troops arrived on the Thames, and sometime later, another 3,000 landed in Hull. With this act of support, the Dutch fulfilled their part of the Barrier Treaty, which stated that the Dutch would provide these troops to defend the Protestant succession. So on the 30th of January of 1716, Mar led the Jacobites out of Perth, and James Francis Edward Stuart wrote a farewell letter to Scotland, and he left and never returned again. So a lot of Jacobite prisoners were tried for treason and sentenced to death. The Indemnity Act of 1717 pardoned all those who had taken, I love this part, they pardoned everyone who had taken part in the rising, except for the whole of Clan Gregor, including Rob Roy MacGregor. They were like specifically excluded from the benefits of this act. So they were like, everyone is pardoned except you.
Damn.
And Rob Roy was, you know, is a famous legend. Can't get into it, but yeah. So James eventually fled to France, where he was, he ended up being no longer welcome because Louis XIV had died and there was a new court of Louis XV. And he was like, nah, I cannot have that drama here. So Pope Clement offered James the Palazzo del Rey in Rome as his residence, which he accepted. And then after spending some time in France, garnering sympathy and supporters, I should say, we're skipping ahead. So James Francis Edward Stuart was living in Rome. His son, Charles Edward Stuart, a.k.a. the Bonnie Prince, was born in Italy, spent most of his life in Italy. And they were just kind of lying in wait because in 1745, well, actually the year before, they decided to take another grab for the English throne. So this is the Bonnie Prince that we all know and hate. So I'm not going to go tell the whole story of the rising because
we just watched it.
Yeah. So after the defeat at Culloden, Charles was secreted to the Isle of Skye and then returned to France, never to set foot on Scottish soil again. 3,500 Jacobites were indicted on charges of treason. 120 were executed. These were like primarily deserters from government forces. 650 died awaiting trial. 900 were pardoned, and the rest were transported to the colonies. And as we all know, Simon Fraser, Lord Levett, was beheaded in April 1747.
Laughing his head off.
Yes. The Jacobite cause didn't entirely disappear after 1746, but everybody was mad at the Bonnie Prince. Like, they were just like, you suck. And the objectives that were left after 1746 were in conflict. So like different Jacobites wanted different things. And that basically ended the movement as a serious political threat. A lot of Scots were disillusioned by Charles's leadership. And there was a big decline in English Jacobitism, which was demonstrated by the lack of support in 1745. So Charles never returned to Scotland or England again. He spent the rest of his days pretty miserable. He was a big drunk and just, you know, his life kind of sucked. Probably not as bad as most people's because he is rich, but, you know. His son, Henry Benedict, this is quite a name, Henry Benedict Thomas Edward Maria Clement Francis Xavier Stuart became a Cardinal Duke of York and was a Roman Catholic cardinal, as well as the fourth and final Jacobite heir to publicly claim the thrones of Great Britain and Ireland, though he actually made no real attempts to grab the throne. But he said, but I am.
Here, right? Like, I'm not going to go anywhere else. But yeah, that's a name, though. That's...
Yeah, so the Stuarts' greatest legacy, in my mind, is that they really liked to declare themselves... like in charge of things that they weren't in charge of. It makes me think of Michael Scott, like, I declare bankruptcy.
Except it's kind of the opposite.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to declare myself the queen of something. And who's going to argue with me? I mean, they can, but I said it. So,
I mean, sure, Your Majesty.
Thank you. Okay, so that ended up being way longer than I anticipated, but it was because a lot of it was really interesting.
there was really good, there was fun tangents. Actually, in our notes, we wrote down finish the history lesson, subpoint, and associated tangents.
I thought that was funny.
I think in favor of the associated tangents, I think we're just going to skip. We're going to skip the quiz.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We don't have time for the quiz.
That we
And totally all Pan is going to remember is gay James VI. So it's fine.
And the chopping him up, chopping him into little tiny pieces and just shipping him off. Why?
I don't
God. The vampire king. That's what we're going to go with.
I'm going to find out why they did that. Because again, a lot of these guys were pretty weird. Like he may have been like, this is what I want to happen to my body. I don't know. We'll find out.
I don't know. Okay. That's odd. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, that was probably my favorite history lesson for the entire series. That was so much fun.
Can you believe I was going to skip a bunch of that?
I'm glad you didn't.
I know.
Because, my God, that was just fascinating.
Yeah. All I can say is that royalty is fucking weird.
So weird.
Especially Scottish royalty. I shouldn't say especially. I mean, the English, we didn't focus on the English for obvious reasons, but like they're totally also, fucked up too. So
also, yes.
Ugh, it's just, oh my God. And I'm not going to get into like a freaking war with anybody or piss anybody off about like the monarchy because I'm American. I don't really have any stake in this game.
Really don't.
But when you look at especially what's happening in the English monarchy right now, and you think about just all the past and how these royal structures came to be, it's just like, are we surprised that we are where we are today?
not particularly.
Not really. No. Anywho.
So let's talk about season three. So we did decide that we are going to continue for season three because Lord John is in season three.
I mean, how could we miss it?
We can't miss it. So here's what we don't have a huge plan. Well, okay, we don't have a timeline. We do have the season planned, mostly. But right. We don't exactly have a timeline. So here's what's going to happen. We are going to do shorter, more structured podcast episodes. So we're going to focus more on like themes and things rather than, you know, going through the events of the episode. So we're going to keep them to 45 minutes or less. And the reason that we're doing this is kind of like we talked about at the beginning, where we got tired.
Yeah.
Not tired of the podcast, just tired in general. Things are just not where they were last year.
And Pan edits all the episodes. So it's very cumbersome to try to edit these super long episodes. It just takes up so much time.
Yeah.
In order to continue for the podcast to feel fun for us, you know, we're making these changes so it's easier for us.
Yes. Because of that, because it's like, how in the hell are we going to talk about all debts paid and of lost things in 45 minutes or less? We're not gonna.
We're not.
So we're already planning multiple podcast episodes for the episodes in the series that have Lord John content. And then we actually are going to combine some episodes that he's not in. So we got a chunk of five.
Yeah. We're going to have like five episodes of lost things and then like one episode for like five episodes. So, you know, it's fine. It's cool.
The next, what is it? The Battle Join, the first episode might be a couple of episodes too, just because of Hal. All the Hal.
Yeah. And it is, I think, one of the best episodes of Outlander. So
it's so good. I'm excited. But that does mean a couple of things. One, for you guys, you don't have to like wait till you have 90 minutes to devote to listening to us prattle on. Because your toilet is probably clean after the first 15 minutes, let's be honest.
Yeah, you don't have to listen to us on the way into work, on the way home from work, and then on the way back into work the next day. You could maybe get it done in one commute.
Yeah, it won't take the entire weekend to get through us droning on. But that also means that for our guest hosts, so it's going to be a little bit less work for them because it's going to be shorter. It's going to be a little bit more structured. But because we're also planning multiple episodes for certain things, it's going to give some more flexibility. So that's a good thing all around. We are going to have some rotating kind of recurring segments as things come up. You know, as the episode allows, we're going to bring up some things. Most notably, the boner scale is coming back.
Yay! And it's not just for Jamie anymore.
It's not just for Jamie. It's the Jamie and or John boner scale. Hey, hey, hey. We're going to keep going with the nerd corner, which was Beth's history lesson over the last. It's not necessarily going to be a history lesson, but we'll do something fun and nerdy.
If something sparks my special interests.
Exactly. Or maybe something will come up and I'll be like, oh, I can answer this question. And I'll just ramble on about some shit. We'll probably do like a rare pair of the week every so often. Could be fun. The one I'm most looking forward to is going to be the hot takes that will get us canceled.
Yes. Well, that's always the best part of Lord John Lander.
That's the best. And then, of course, I'm sure we will have plenty of FUDG and FU stars moments.
Yep, absolutely.
And more things, some surprises. But let's talk about how we're going to handle this. So season 7 is starting this summer, but we, as of recording this, we don't have a premiere date. Right? We don't, because I haven't been on Twitter.
No. Okay. No. And because of really good personal things going on in my life, I am going to be incredibly busy from like mid-March until the end of April. So we're really not planning on doing much, if any, recording from basically now until the end of April.
So sometime in May, we'll start recording again.
Right. And because we don't know when season 7 is going to premiere, it's kind of on the fence if we're going to start season 3, because we are going to do season 7 in real time. So basically, we're going to watch the episode on Sunday, record on Monday, do a quick edit, and have it posted by Friday. But those episodes are going to be even shorter. They're actually not going to follow this structure really that we established for season 3, because they're going to be more just reactionary, right? Like the last two seasons we went into it having very intimate knowledge of both the show and the books. And we do have intimate knowledge of the book season 7 is based on, but we're going to be just reacting to what happens in the show. So there'll be shorter, more reaction-based episodes. But because we don't know the premiere date, we have not been able to decide yet if we're going to start posting season 3, take a pause, and then do season 7, and then go back to season 3, or if we're just going to wait for season 7, do season 7, and then do season 3 when season 7's over. So it's a little up in the air right now, but don't worry, we do have a plan. We just have to wait for Stars to tell us the date.
Yes. They have a plan too. We just don't freaking know what it is. And our plan kind of depends on their plan. So we're going to treat that as a separate season. So we will not be doing season 3 and rewatch episodes at the same time that we do season 7 real time episodes, quote unquote real time. Right. We're not getting that. Right. We won't be getting the episode in advance like official podcasts would. Because ain't nobody going to pay us to do this. It's not going to happen.
Imagine like writing to Stars and being like, hey, can you listen to our podcast and then give us money?
No.
And advanced episodes to trash your show.
It would be the literal opposite of what would happen.
So, yeah.
We'd get C&Ds.
I have really big hopes for season 7.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like I've disliked any seasons, but we just look at them with a more critical eye sometimes.
Right. Season 7 will still be fresh, new, and exciting for us. And so we'll have more nice things to say.
Yes.
But also they're going to be shorter because, you know, we typically record at least 2 weeks in advance to give us plenty of time to edit. That won't be the thing. So we'll see what happens. We will let you know. So make sure that you are following us on Tumblr and Twitter at Lord John Lander in both places. You can also find us on WordPress at lordjohnlander.wordpress.com.
WordPress.com. Yes.
In the meantime, you are welcome to go to our Contact Us page if you want to send us some mail over our little hiatus. We would love to read it, and maybe we can give you a shout-out next season, whichever next season is, whether it's 3 or whether it's 7. We don't know. But we will tell you when we do.
So remain faithful, friends. We will be back. We're just going to deal with some life stuff and wait to find out when season 7 is going to start.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Beth, thank you for another wonderful season. I have so much enjoyed doing this podcast with you again.
Same here. Thank you for putting up with my nerddom history lessons. I liked for myself taking a little dive into like, you know, how did we get here to this point? I didn't know a lot of Scottish history, and now I do, and I'm interested to find more, but like, thanks for indulging that and letting me have my nerd corner.
Well, and you put so much work into it. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Shout out to Ness and to Ash for joining us this season. It was so great to have both of you on. Look forward to getting to talk to you maybe in season 3 as well.
Hopefully. Yeah, we probably won't have guests on season 7 for our season 7 stuff unless like the stars just completely align, but we definitely will be having guests for season 3, and hopefully we'll have some more guests too. All
right. And thank you guys, our listeners. We could do it without you, but it's much more fun knowing that a few of you are out there listening to us. We could scream into the void. We're very good at that. But no, sincerely, thank you for your support again for another season. And I am so excited to see you next season.
Me too. Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you're listening to this, it means you survived another episode of Lord Johnlander. We'd love to hear from you on Twitter or Tumblr at Lord Johnlander or on our website at lordjohnlander.wordpress.com/contact us.
All opinions expressed on the Lord Johnlander podcast belong to us and are not affiliated with Outlander, Sony, Stars, and definitely 100% not with Diana Gabaldon.
This podcast is not suitable for children, immature adults, homophobes, anyone who takes fandom seriously, people who don't understand that the characters aren't real, people with sticks up their ass, people who hate fun, and people with no sense of humor. Do not try any of these hot takes at home. We are professionals.
And if you know us in real life, no, you don't.